Blog Talk Radio.
Rah. Killer Mike Bamboo. You already know. Yeah. No surprise, I'm from a gangbang culture, but we can keep it civil or pull a thang-thang on ya. Southern California where the sun don't quit, intergenerational gang so sons don't quit. But immediately you see that the problems that's in my city are secondary to what's propelling it in my city. I mean really break it down, take poor black and brown, educate them poor, take the jobs from out the town, then inundate them with the date of drugs and dumb TV, locked into a zoo and hunted daily by the police. Then you get a group of youth who know they don't belong, then they gather up and organize a number up strong. But see, the failure isn't seeing that the problem ain't the gang, it's the situation in the communities where we hang. So I'm so pro-gang, it might scare a motherfucker, cause I fix the misconception that the enemies are brothers.
Bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, upset the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, homie, we been set up.
I tell them, I went from a street gang thing, then I joined a military fleet marine force thing. From a little bitty gang in the south of Los Angeles to dragging bodies out of their house to help a government who hell bent on keeping money spent on the missile. The reality's the difference between them shits is little. We had the objective of arming up over money, and they had the objective of arming up over money. And we told kids, join us, we the truth. Lies about protecting our black to get recruits. Then we found out we getting killed for a hood, and we don't own a single speck of dirt on that hood. Whether in a zone down south in Decatur, or in a flatlands off of Lenox and La Brea, or in a low-rise project in Chicago, big money come in and buy up our body.
So your sets up, we about to upset the setup. We about to upset the setup. Up to upset the setup. Throw your sets up, we about to upset the setup. Upset the setup. Up to upset the setup.
I do it for the Crips and the Blooders. BGF brothers, the real Freeway Ricky Ross and Chris Dutters. I do my thing for Hoover, I represent for Ford. So my folk and my people, so they set to support. Support a mean to Matthew, she might say the shot. So maybe next summer, no mama's gotta cry. Cause maybe next summer, nobody gotta die. Hell, even if we fail, somebody gotta try. The only way the system rule is somebody gotta lie. And the lie they told is old, they base it on your race. They separate you black, you brown, you yellow, and white face. Then we further separate by joining gangs and legislate. That our neighborhoods are now at war like we are separate states. So the police occupy our hood to keep down all the drama. So the Starbucks they just built is comfortable for soccer mama. And American Apparel comfortable for all the hipsters. And it's zero tolerance for all you spicks and you niggas and you chinks and you crackers. And it ain't about who's whiter and it ain't about who's blacker, but the money is a factor. And the factor is the factor we've got moved up out the hood. When starvation is present and absent is a job, a man with simple scars, or he will form a mob. If you should form a mafia, then you should think Sicilian. Buy the hood for real. Every block, every building, every build, every build. Feed the chill, feed the chill. Gang bang, gang bang. Build, build. Feed the chill, feed the chill. Feed the chill, feed the chill. Gang bang, gang bang. On the system, on the system.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes. And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the
Soledad Brothers! Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson, sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret.
TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Real live. Welcome to another this George University Radio. I'm your host, Dumont Shakir, where our goals are fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate functional literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal is to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal is to transform the criminal mentality to a new African mentality. Our fourth goal is to assist in rebuilding and stabilization of new African community. And our fifth goal is to prepare a new African prisoner for release, reducing new African recidivism. And our overall goal is transferring the whole prison to slave complex to the prison system and the mind, the criminal mentality, to the biggest institution of learning in the world. Before I bring on a guest now, I'll let go of a couple of events that happened in history during this week. On January 2nd, 1800, the anti-slave petition from Free Blacks Philadelphia presented to Congress. 1863, Harriet Tubman, Cumberhee River Raid. 1872, Mississippi legislation met. John R. Lynch was elected Speaker of the House at the age of 24. In 1884, Oscar Mouche, author, film director, and independent producer of 40 films, who also challenged racism through his work, became known as the father of black seminar, was born. In 1911, noted black author and anthropologist, St. Claude Drake, was born. In 1915, John Hope Franklin, historian and author, was born. In 1965, the voter registration drive led by Martin Luther King started in Selma, Alabama. In 1977, Errol Garner, jazz pianist, died in Los Angeles at the age of 53. Also, in 2011, former New African political prisoner, Geronimo G. Jaga, dies of a heart attack in Tanzania. On January 3rd, 1961, Representative Adam Clayton Powell Jr. of Harlem was elected chairman of the House of Education and Labor Committee. In 1966, Floyd B. McKissick, North Carolina attorney, named National Director of Congress of Race Equality Corps. In 1966, SNCC, which is the Student National Coordinating Committee, activist Samuel Young Jr. was killed in Tuskegee, Alabama. In 1969, Representative Adam Clayton Powell Jr. was seated by Congress. In 1989, Representative John Tyers, a Democrat from Detroit, was elected the chairman of the Government Operations Committee of the House of Representatives. On January 4, 1901, T.R.L. James, author, political economy historian, born in Antonio Pene, Trinidad. In 1909, the Amsterdam News was founded. In 1920, the National Negro Baseball League was established. In 1971, Dr. Melvin H. Evans inaugurated as the first elected governor of the Virgin Islands. Also in 1971, Reverend Leon H. Sullivan named to the board of directors of General Motors and became the first black director of America's biggest corporation. In 1972, Dr. Angela Davis was acquitted of murder and kidnapping charges. In 1985, Leontine Price made her farewell appearance at New York Metropolitan Opera in the title role of Ida. Representative William H. Gray III, elected chairman of the House of Budget Committee, the highest congressional post held to date by a black. And today, January 5th, in 1804, Ohio legislature passed the first of succession of Northern Black laws that restricted the rights and movement of free blacks in the North. Most Northern states passed black laws. Constitutions of three states, Illinois, Indiana, or Oregon, barred black settlers. 1943, Senator George Washington Carver died of Tuskegee at the age of 78. In 1999, Anthony Williams sworn in as a mayor of Washington, D.C. On January 6th, New England anti-slave, this is 1832, New England anti-slave organized at the African Baptist Church on Boston Beacon Hill. In 1949, UN mediator Ralph Bunche announced that Israel and Egypt had accepted a ceasefire. In 1966, Harold R. Perry became second black Roman Catholic bishop in United States history. In 1971, Cecil A. Partee elected president pro tem of the Illinois State Senate. In 1989, Elizabeth D. Kuntz, former head of the National Education Association, died in Salisbury, North Carolina at the age of 69. In 1993, Dizzy Gillespie, jazz trumpeter and one of the founders of the modern jazz, died in Inglewood, New Jersey at the age of 75. On January 7, 1837, Weekly Advocate, the second major black newspaper found in New York. The name was later changed to the Colored American. Some 400 black newspapers were published before the Civil War. 1868, Mississippi Constitutional Convention. 17 blacks, 83 whites met in Jackson. Also in 1868, the Arkansas Constitutional Convention. 8 blacks and 43 whites met in Little Rock. In 1890, W.B. Purvis invented and patented the fountain pen. 1891, Zora Neale Hurston, writer, was born in Florida. 1955, Mary Anderson made debut at Metropolitan Opera House as Ulrich in Verdi's Masked Ball. She was the first black singer in the company's history. In 1966, Martin Luther King Jr. opened their first major campaign in the North, calling for desegregation and equal rights in the city of Chicago, a major bastion of the Democratic Party and one of the most segregated cities in America. 1976, Dr. Mary Frances Berry, named Chancellor of the University of Colorado. In 1985, Colonel Frederick Gregory, who was born in 1941, nationalized the first black to command a space shuttle mission in April 1985. Okay. January the 8th through the 10th, 1811. Louisiana slaves rebelled in two parishes about 35 miles from New Orleans. Charles Deslonnais led the revolt. It was suppressed by U.S. troops. In 1863, President Lincoln told a Union general that he tried for nearly a year and a half to keep from touching slavery, and that it was possible for whites to adopt a policy of gradualism and apprenticeship that would soften the impact of emancipation. In 1867, legislation giving the suffrage to blacks in the District of Columbia was passed over President John Andrew Johnson's veto. In 1912, the African National Congress, ANC, Africa's oldest liberation movement, was founded in Zambia, South Africa. In 1922, Colonel Charles R. Young, the high-ranking black in the Army, died in Lagos, Nigeria, at the age of 58. In 1982, the Reagan administration changed an 11-year policy of refusing tax-exempt status to private colleges and nonprofit institutions that discriminate racially. Well, that's a couple of events that happened in history of the week. It's a lot more. But I would like to say, free land of all those lending for our land, relishing their ingredients, free all the new African political prisoners, free all the Catholic New African citizens, free all the New York POW, free all the political prisoners, free all the POWs. I'd like to thank everybody who been joining our broadcast in 2014. I would thank everybody who's educating themselves and doing work in their communities, doing work with their family, doing work to better themselves, as well as better others. And with all I do, I'd like to bring on tonight Professor Toussaint Lozier. Real life, Rubber Scooter. How you doing here, brother? Yeah, so how you doing here, brother?
Well, doing pretty well. Hanging in there, you know, amidst these trying times. How are things on your end?
Yeah, I'm well, brother. I'm strong, safe, and sane, man. Pushing forward, man. Doing what I can do when I can, when I'm able to do it. That's what it's about. But before we get First of all, thank you for coming to our broadcast, sharing your knowledge and understanding. Thanks for the work you did in the past, present, the work you're doing in the future. And first off, can you tell the people about yourself, tell them who you are, how you came up, how you grew up, and, you know, tell them a little basis of who you are before we get into this.
Born and raised in Philadelphia, West Philadelphia to be specific. My father's side of the family is originally from Haiti, in and around Port-au-Prince. He came here when he was about 16. And then my mom's side of the family is originally from Detroit, before that, North Carolina. And so, you know, my mom, having grown up during the 60s, was involved in some of the organizing at her high school, was involved in the Detroit chapter of the Black Panther Party, and some of the work that led to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. And, you know, was raised with some of their political foundations in terms of just, you know, outlook on the world and commitment to the community. And so kind of out of that have been trying to find ways to kind of build towards both, like, scholarship that's committed to academic excellence, but also social responsibility, community responsibility in terms of being involved in organizing in the community, whether that's been here on the East Coast where I live now or prior to that in Chicago. Also doing doing research mostly in history that's focused on really trying to provide some clarity, some sense of how is it that we got to this point in time. And a lot of that research is focused on the growth of the prison system, mass incarceration, prison industrial complex, trying to, you know, have a clear sense in terms of what are the ways in which the prison system grew to the scale that it is today? And then at the same time, what are the ways in which movements of the past to try to challenge that, to undermine the way in which that system works? And then what are some of the ways in which the prison system, kind of in response to some of those movements, has grown to the scale that it has today? And so I'm currently based at the W.B. Du Bois Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, out here in Massachusetts. And most of the teaching that I do is either in Black history or politics, with a focus on the criminal justice system, war on drugs, political movements, Black politics more generally, things of that nature.
Okay. You mentioned the prison justice slave complex, right? For the people who are listening, can you give them a breakdown of exactly what you mean by that? What exactly it is and how does it affect us as people?
I think this program is probably one of the better ones that it's done a good job of kind of laying that out. But, you know, I think at a fundamental level, the prison industrial slave complex has been based on figuring out how to served pretty much as a mechanism of social control, but in like a collective sense. in the sense that for black folks, for new Africans, the prison industrial state complex has served as a way in which to more effectively at a particular position within this broader society. And part of what I've been most focused on recently is looking at the way in which growth of that prison industrial slave complex really took off at a particular moment in which it was trying to contend and arrest particular ways in which the new African independence movement was gaining traction in both, within it in terms of the struggles that were taking place in prison during the late 70s, early 1980s, as well as those taking place on the street outside as well. And that that kind of focus on trying to figure out how best to, kind of keep us at the bottom rung of society and put us in the position that made it easy to kind of to stop and also roll back some of the gains, some of the steps forward that struggles in the past had made. That the prison industrial complex, slave complex, has kind of played that role, has served that role, on top of being able to strip us of political power, exploit us for our labor, kind of perpetuate some of what you referred to earlier in terms of illiteracy and things of that nature. That kind of first and foremost, I've been most interested in trying to make sense of kind of how that question of a vehicle for controlling and constraining, our struggles, that's a key role that prison industrial state complex has played.
True indeed. My next question is, what type of influence did your mom have on you from being a part of the Black Panther Party in Detroit and was the League of Revolutionary Workers? Was there any kind of type of literature laying around, or was there any comrades around, or did you possibly meet anybody, or what kind of influence did she have on your political development and your racial love of history?
First and foremost, it was a lot of the literature that she had around, from collected speeches of Malcolm X to Frantz Fanon, a lot of the poetry of the Black Arts Movement, those old 25 cent, 50 cent chapbooks that, June Jordan, Sonny Sanchez, Heidi Makowoody put out, just a lot of those. But kind of more than anything, just kind of an orientation in terms of trying to figure out how to make sense of the world. And then beyond that, it was less so, introducing me to people in the sense of like former comrades of hers, but a real profound connection and orientation towards the African continent. So, not only our history here in this country, but also, a push to learn about African history, opportunity, you know, pushed me to travel to West Africa and actually had an opportunity. She ended up living there for a little while. She lived in Cote d'Ivoire, West Africa, and then later in South Africa. And so had an opportunity to spend at least a little bit of time living with her while she was there. So that kind of real sort of like political foundation in terms of a real appreciation for our history, and then also a real desire to learn more. And I think more than anything, reading through some of those books she had, and I think the piece that always sort of stuck in my mind was the quote from where he says, "Of all our studies, history is best suited to reward our research." That idea that having a kind of clear a clear sense of what you know, what we've been through in the past and what our history is kind of the best means by which to figure out how best to figure things out going forward.
Okay. True indeed. You know, history is a weapon. I mean, you lied, if you lied to liberate us, you lied to enslave us. My next question is, right, what can you tell us the meaning of your name and also tell a little bit about what type of influence your father had about being from the Haitian, from the Haitian background?
My parents named me after Toussaint Louverture, who was one of the more prominent leaders of the Haitian Revolution, the anniversary which we just celebrated, for the anniversary of Haitian independence, which was the product of that revolution we just celebrated a couple of days ago, January 1st. I think, you know, my father's influence, my mom was kind of involved in like the anti-apartheid movement and some of the struggles taking place in and around that. But my father was very involved in the struggle around in Haiti that followed the fall of the Duvalier dictatorship, really the overthrow of the Duvalier dictatorship. Yeah. It was being able to not only learn about the Haitian Revolution and that history, but even more importantly, seeing the way in which folks were organizing here in ways that were directly connected to the effort to put in place some form of like true people's democracy in Haiti, and the way in which folks were mobilizing, whether it was, you know, in Philadelphia, you know, those marches that took place on the Brooklyn Bridge in New York City and what have you, and then also the kind of backlash against that and the repression that took place after the Aristide in 1991. And some of the ways in which folks continue to organize in terms of trying to see him reinstated. That whole dynamic in terms of the ways in which the Haitian community and other folks here kind of tried to push back against, you know, that CIA-backed coup and the ways in which, the kind of imperialist forces were attempting to prevent any sort of push forward, at least in that case, was a real profound example, not just in terms of being able to have a sense of like, this is what the history looks like, or these are elements of the culture, but also to see in which the ways in which they were being put into practice in the service of the movement at that moment in time. And that was a really, important lessons. There were a host of important lessons in that, in terms of being able to see what movements, what people's movements can achieve, and then also some of the challenges and some of the ways that they can get, you know, repressed, undermined, thrown back, and kind of what are some of the dangers, and what are, you know, what are the ways in which folks need to approach those situations strategically in terms of how to avoid some of those pitfalls.
True indeed, true indeed. My next question is, I understand that you're a professor at the W. Du Bois Department of African American Studies, right? This is just a two-part question. What exactly are African American Studies, and have you had the opportunity to either teach out a chapter of some of the books you co-authored, or teach out any publications that you wrote to your students?
So one of the things I really appreciate about at UMass is it has a very rich sense of itself as a direct sense of how African American studies came out of you know, the movement of the 1960s and 70s, particularly at that moment, you know, the Black liberation struggle and the ways in which that in the kind of institutionalization, quote unquote, professionalization, quote unquote, of African American studies as an academic discipline was supposed to the needs and the kind of broader development of the movement. And so it has a real rich sense of that movement history. You know, if you our offices were located in New Africa House, which is a former student dorm that was occupied by those students who were demanding Black studies on campus. And you walk inside, and on the left-hand side is a mural of Amilcar Cabral. And on the right is the entrance to the Augusta Savage Gallery, which is named after this famous sculptor from the Harlem Renaissance. So there's that, but also I think more broadly, that kind of informs how I understand what African American studies is supposed to be about in terms of an intellectual project that obviously goes back decades in terms of a lot of the racist misconceptions about, you know, our history as a people and our intellectual contributions, our broader cultural contributions to our own development, and then, you know, a project that's concerned with finding ways to, you know, to figure out how to make sense of the current circumstances that we find ourselves in and how to improve them. So that's one thing. And then the other thing to your second question, you know, I haven't really made a priority of like teaching any of my own scholarship to my students. I've really been much more interested in trying to get them to learn from, to develop their own opinions of some of the material that I've drawn on in terms of the scholarship that I've done, right? So, you know, one of the pieces is this book that I did with Dan Berger called Rethinking the American Prison Movement. And rather than teach them that book, which is about, you know, the history of prisoner organizing, I'm much more interested in having the students, you know, read some of the other histories that people have written, and some of the different interpretations or different parts of that history that folks have put out there, and being able to kind of draw on that themselves and sort of think about how they can, you know, how they could, you know, do some of that history or contribute to a better understanding of that history on their own part, rather than simply taking, you know, or echoing or just regurgitating the stuff that I put out there. And I think it's funny because, like, I had a friend in school who used to complain about professors assigning their own books. He always used to complain that it felt like professors did that just because they wanted people to buy their books, and, you know, that it was just kind of a way for them to kind of put money in their own pocket. And from that, I remember having conversations around that and just kind of having in my mind, like, look, I don't want to be that guy who's just like, you read the syllabus for the class, or you go into the class and all you see is the professor's own stuff. I wanted to at least be in a sense of saying, okay, let me, rather than just seeing what I've written, let me give you a chance to see sort of where, you know, where other people have tried to kind of make some sense of what's happening here. There's a couple articles, there's a couple short pieces that I have put on syllabi or have put into my classes, but most of the time I try to have the students read and, you know, say I like this, I don't like this when it comes to other people's work.
Okay. I understand exactly what you're saying, you know. You basically saying that you want the individual to develop his or her own identity from doing research, doing their own work, doing their own experience, developing their own identity that resonates and relates to the particular study that they participate in going through at that time, in particular, right, in their timeline, and also being able to get their information and identity and put it into effect and how they're going to contribute not only to themselves but to the masses as a whole. That's the understanding I'm getting from that, what you're saying, right?
Sometimes it's too much. Sometimes you see people who, you know, because they're academics or because they're scholars, just want to kind of like create, you know, reproduce copies of themselves, or make the kind of like the focus of any education that they do with a student simply about how somebody adopts and picks up on their own, you know, way of doing what they do. And I think it's much more important to be somebody else helping a student or whomever their own ideas and their own interests, their own intellectual development in the greatest way possible that kind of builds on the interests, the kind of motivations, the passions that brought them, you know, whether it's a classroom or what have you, that brought them there in the first place, you know? So.
True indeed. No, I know you mentioned that the book that you called Rethinking the American Prison System. Can you tell me what was the inspiration behind it? What was the inspiration that inspired you, you and Dan Berger, to work on this book, or how did it come about, so to speak?
It came about kind of happenstance. Basically, there was this project that was focused on trying to, purely from an academic purpose, to kind of get an updated, short version of histories of different movements. So the overall project is called Rethinking Social Movements. And, you know, there's one on, like, the Civil Rights Movement, the Welfare Rights Movement, the, you know, movements such as that. And that the kind of motivation or the opportunity for Dan and I to work on it, on this particular project came about basically as an offer to say, look, there's been, you know, this was, you know, this was several years ago, but, you know, there's been a lot more interest out of the university, out of the academy in terms of kind of like researching and writing on prisons. You know, why don't y'all take the opportunity to kind of like go through some of that new scholarship and see, you know, what people have put on the table. And Dan and I both come at this with an eye towards the actual organizing that folks are doing in terms of trying to, you know, dismantle the system rather than just sort of like study it. And out of that, we're interested in trying to not just look at the scholarship or even look at the history of the movement, but really try to get a sense of the way in which organizing has changed over the years, and the ways in which those changes have been effective in terms of aspects of the prison system, industrial slave complex, and that the way in which that system has responded to some of those movements. So, you know, we wanted to do it almost in kind of like a dialectical way in terms of thinking about what are the ways in which, you know, folks have struggled against the system, you know, brought about some changes, but then also how has the system changed in response to those struggles and those challenges. So we started going all the way back to, like, say, the 1865, you know, post-13th Amendment, and looking at the emergence of the convict lease system in the South, and early campaigns around the use of convict labor, efforts to kind of abolish that, other challenges to, you know, both waves of political repression and kind of political, you know, people. Particularly looked at basically from that history how we, you know, kind of prisons haven't remained sort of static institutions, but we've been, the way we put it is that the prisons have effectively been through four different stages since that period in 1865, where, you know, that you have the kind of focus on the kind of hyper-exploitation of folks who were incarcerated that we saw during the convict lease system that really remained a key focus of what incarceration was about up until about like the 1930s and 40s. And kind of in that era, because of some different reforms and also some of the struggles that were taking place behind bars, you get a shift from a kind of workhouse model of imprisonment to what we call the big house model. And this is a period where you see from Jackson State Prison in Michigan to some of the kind of more, you know, reformatory oriented efforts in places that range from like Folsom in California to Stateville in Illinois to some, you know, you don't just have like a highly repressive environment behind bars, but you have at least a language of corrections or reform that places prisons as an institution that's about correcting the individual in various different ways, different methods from one institution to the next. And how it's in the context of that sort of reformatory aspect of incarceration that you get, you know, the growth of the Nation of Islam behind bars, you get some of the prisoner litigation that takes place during the 1950s and 1960s, and really the kind of the foundation being laid for the prison movement that's kind of best identified, best connected to George Jackson. And it's really in response to the kind of contradictions of a kind of more liberal, reform-oriented approach to imprisonment and the realities, particularly for new African prisoners, of what life is like behind bars, that you get kind of, you know, the kind of revolutionary struggles, the organizing, whether it's around prison labor, whether it's around sort of prison rights that takes place during the 60s and the 70s. And it's really in response to that that you get, in response to those struggles, that you get a shift in terms of how incarceration is operating that's more explicitly and kind of separated from this question of kind of reform or corrections and more solidly focused on just questions of institutional security. Sort of kind of warehouse model of incarceration that kind of in tracing the relationship between the ways in which prison organizing is operating and the way in which kind of institution shifts, that we try to say, look, you know, the growth of the prison system, the growth of the prison industrial slave complex that we've seen take place, you know, at an astronomical rate since the 1980s, is a variety of different things. But one of those things that kind of often gets left to the side is the way in which this emphasis on institutional security, this emphasis on, you know, mass prison building and building prison institutions that are supposed to be kind of riot-proof and able to hold, you know, people, that this focus on kind of warehousing as the sort of sole purpose, warehousing individuals as sort of the sole purpose of incarceration, comes out of this period of struggle and comes out of the effort to in slight different ways, the way in which prisons operate in tune with and in response to some of those challenges that the prison movement of the 60s, 70s, and early 80s had put forward. And so we really wanted to try to not just say, here's the kind of history of the movement, but also try to really put forward a way of trying to make sense that hopefully others could pick up and kind of build on how, you know, movements operate. They make demands, and in some ways those demands make headway. You know, they're able to win some things, but other instances there's reaction, there's backlash, and that backlash can have an impact in terms of the way the system changes in response, and, you know, establishes in some ways a new foundation upon which folks then have to struggle and make a way forward later on. bit of a long-winded response. So,
brother, we are good.
Oh, my bad, Matt. My bad. I'm sorry, brother.
No, no,
I was talking. Okay.
No,
Okay, let me repeat what I was saying.
Sure.
I was saying from reading your book, rethinking the American prison system, right? It reminds me of things I don't read years ago when I read Bob Sunata Cole's book, Other His New African Struggle, right?
Exactly.
It talks
exactly.
about a lot of things.
Yeah.
It talks about a lot of things from the convict elite system, and the 40s, 30s, 20s, so forth and so on, right? And one of the things that I see in your book that is highlighted for people who got a conscious eye that it shows how people incarcerated, how people that were captured or political prisoners, so forth and so on.
Yep.
How they basically combated things around them, combat things such as racial attacks, white supremacy, combat things such as deprivation of food, deprivation of medical, deprivation of human rights.
Yep.
And it shows in detail throughout the certain aspect you talked about in regards to Conrad George Jackson, the Solidarity Brothers, the San Quentin Six, the Attica rebellions, and all the other situations that occurred, even the aspect of people creating study groups. You had Black Panther Party prison chapters and so forth and so on, right? And I look at that, I look at all that as a way to, it was basically survival tactics, you know, survival tactics. And also, like you said earlier, that the system has created certain ways to also certain aspects of struggle in regards to creating special management units, shield units, lockdown units, the censorship of mail, splitting people up, putting people in the hole, the physical attacks of people, medically deaf, medically induced deaths, so forth and so on, right?
Yeah.
And all of that stuff is very detrimental. You know, and not only are these struggles occurring in the prison system, they also have a reflection in the outside world because a lot of people outside the world are connected to them and actually working with the individuals and organizations, right? So that's a beautiful thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. I just want to say that, you know?
For sure. No, I really appreciate that because Baba Sundiata's piece on the history of the new African prison struggle was a significant influence in terms of trying to understand and appreciate that long history of struggle, and then also the different ways that the kind of different phases of or the kind of, you know, the way in which that struggle has changed over time. You know, is important and needs to be appreciated in terms of understanding, kind of in the way I said earlier, like how we got to where we are right now. And that the, you know, in some ways, part of what I think we were trying to respond to was a way in which even by folks who are abolitionists, there's a way in which you know, folks can kind of like fall back on a way of talking about all those different aspects of repression behind bars, whether it's the medical neglect, whether it's the special management units, 23, you know, hour lockdowns, 23 and a half hours, all that stuff, that to not appreciate or understand that as a kind of like, not just as a terrain of struggle, but as a consequence or as a backlash to prior struggles. You know, there's a way that simply the language around those different aspects of how the prison industrial slave complex works can just be framed in terms of like, this is a question of human rights, or this is a moral question, or, you know, things of that nature, without quite understanding or appreciating that those different characteristics of what we face today, that those are, you know, products or aspects of these previous rounds of struggle that have taken place that are a result of trying to contain or repress all those different things that you said that, you know, come out of the history of the Attica Rebellion, you know, the Soledad Brothers, the prison study groups, the writ writing, the prisoner litigation, all that kind of struggle that took place in the past, that as a backlash to that, you know, we get the Prison Litigation Reform Act. You know, we get the isolation of captives, of prisoners of war, of political prisoners, that those dynamics that we see today are consequences to efforts to prevent, you know, folks today from doing what was done in the past and done, you know, effectively in pretty different ways, you know, during previous periods of our history.
True indeed. You know, a lot of the history that we're talking about, you know, we carry on that vision now, but with Georgetown mm-hmm. University being an extension of all of that that took place, especially ideology, Comrade George, the work and effort, as well as the other mm-hmm. movements in prison that had developed over the last 20 years. You know what I'm saying? Be it the WNO, the mentorship program. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the New African Collective Think Tank in your book, which is a movement of the Free Alabama movement, the Free Mississippi movement, the Free South Carolina movement, J.R. Mm-hmm. Lawyer Speak, the Prison Life mm-hmm. Lab movement, so much, so on, right? It's a lot of things. There's a lot of people that are engaged in certain aspects of struggle, and the conditions mm-hmm. are different, but similar in every particular system. Incarceration, sure. But the organization maybe did have different names and different aspects of things, but it's an overall mm-hmm. connection. It's just like we understood that the Folsom Manifesto was written in 1970. Whereas the Attica Manifesto was written in 1971. And the Attica Manifesto was taken from the same words that the Folsom Manifesto said, mm-hmm. came around certain aspects of, but the original manifesto sure. came out of Folsom, you know, mm-hmm. and a lot of that manifesto, a lot of that came from inspired from the work of W. L. Nolan, you know,
mm-hmm.
who was assassinated,
yep.
you know, W.
Yep.
L. Nolan, you know, so who was mm-hmm. assassinated, you know,
mm-hmm.
so a lot of this stuff is interesting in regard to historical connections, and especially in regard to ways. To protect yourself, way to survive, all the stuff to make for survival. Now, we understand
yep.
and realize that the prison does slave complex, the prison system, is possibly the biggest business in the world. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Due to the fact that it's legal. It's legalized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's legalized in captivity, legalized slavery, and different
mm-hmm.
imperialists and capitalist corporations and businesses can invest in it. They even can create
mm-hmm.
it by their own, have made their own private prison. They invest in it, you know. They invest
mm-hmm.
in this mass incarceration, you know,
mm-hmm.
that is new Jim
mm-hmm.
Crow, what they want to call it. They can invest in this and
sure.
benefit from it. You know, it destroys
yep.
a lot of people's mind states.
Yeah.
It destroys a lot of community, it destroys a lot of family.
A lot of families, yeah.
It's really wild to be thinking
mm-hmm.
about it, man. But, you know, it's something to be abreast of, because mathematically, it's possible that every person either knows somebody
incarcerated
mm-hmm.
or has somebody that they know that's incarcerated, you know, or knows
sure.
somebody knows
mm-hmm.
somebody incarcerated, you know, that map
yep.
not even possible. And that they go
yep.
to show you how the system exactly affects society, how it affects the masses of the people.
Exactly.
Now, a lot of, in certain situations, your brothers and sisters that wouldn't have any blind that don't educate themselves and who actually don't educate their family while they're incarcerated. You know, so
mm-hmm.
your brothers and sisters that are educating themselves and educate their family on the street, and their family became
mm-hmm.
More self-realized, a better productive people in society, and made better
mm-hmm.
contributions due to the fact that they got people behind enemy lines who going to transfer their mentality from criminal mentality to rebel mentality through education. You know what I'm saying? Through progressive
yep.
reading, the progressive study, the progressive application. You know, not along with the many people and political prisoners and POWs that are still writing, creating programs,
mm-hmm.
and educating them, people inside, as well as people on the outside, you know, in lieu of that, which is very beneficial.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And in taking place in spite of the conditions that they find themselves in, you know, in spite of the exactly what you were saying earlier in terms of how those institutions are set up in a certain way in which, you know, they can very easily, you know, not only destroy particular, you know, aspects of the community or people's families, but also, you know, just, you know, really undermine, deteriorate, you know, people's own sense of themselves, you know what I'm saying? And their own, you know, their own sense of themselves, you know, that work that you just pointed to is taking place in spite of the way in which those institutions operate.
We understood that if you're doing anything that considered to be I'm gonna say anything that continue to maintain that you want to be self that entails self determination. I'm gonna put it like that. Anything that deal with self determination, it considered to be criminal. Because you're not following the system of capitalism, following the system of imperialism, following the system of fascism, and so forth and so on, right? And you want to do different
mm-hmm.
things. You may have socialistic views. You may have
mm-hmm.
communistic views. You may have New African Revolutionary Nationalist views. You may have pan-African socialist views, pan-African views, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that considered to be criminal according to the system, right? Just because you want to change your mind, say, here's how you want
mm-hmm.
to develop on a different level, you know what I'm saying? Become a better person, become a new man, a new woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I look at that situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I look at the way people are being attacked due to their political beliefs, right? Or even
mm-hmm.
being assassinated or captured or forced into exile because of their political beliefs, right? I look
sure.
at that being inhumane. You know, it's inhumane
sure.
treatment, you know, in regards to that, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's inhumane treatment, man.
Exactly.
You know, reality.
Yep.
You know, and I want to ask you, do you believe the system
mm-hmm.
gonna be reformed? Do you actually believe in anything that deal with reform? Is reform a actuality or is it more of a myth? And for your own opinion.
Yeah, I think it's more of a myth. I think the only way in which I'm interested or looking at questions of reform here and there is really the way in which those reforms have an opportunity to kind of open up space in which folks can you know, more effectively struggle or kind of create
a better set of circumstances or conditions, you know, on which they can, you know, push forward the work that they're doing, either to better transform themselves individually or transform the way in which the institution operates. So it's not so much, it wouldn't be so much as a question of like reform as a goal, as an end in and of itself, but more as a question of kind of what opportunity that, you know, that reform might open up for other, you know, like, you know, other work that folks are looking to do. Say, for instance, you know, on the demands that the Jailhouse Lawyers Speak put forward, I guess that was back in like 2016, and again in 2018, those 10 demands, like one of them is, you know, a reform around rescinding the Prison Litigation Reform Act, the piece of legislation, the federal legislation I mentioned earlier. You know, that set of demands is a set of different reforms. I would see there being something useful in terms of saying rescinding the Prison Litigation Reform Act, only to the degree that doing so would open up more like tactical opportunities in terms of people's opportunities to struggle behind bars, particularly in terms of the opportunities for prisoner litigation in a way that's broader than just a kind of very narrow type of suits that can be filed right now. But, you know, I think looking at reform as something that is going to be a solution in and of itself is, I think, you know, it's a complete fallacy, and I think the way you put it in terms of a myth kind of just speaks to not only how false it is, but also the way in which there is an illusion, right, or even a whole kind of mythology around like creating certain reforms that will solve the problem in and of themselves. I think once you get into the history of a lot of that prisoner organizing, you see the way in which, I mean, that's the other thing, I think, other reason why I think that history is important is because you see that the kind of the myth of reform again and again being proven, you know, being proven wrong over time. So,
true indeed. You know, for people listening, do you have any upcoming publications or books that you about to put out, or anything that's upcoming, anything else that you don't publish that people can look out for or they actually can read?
Yeah, the piece that I put out most recently is the is this piece on this really important work by James Yaki Sales called Meditations on Frantz Fanon's Wretched the Earth. And so the piece that they can read now that's on that is called Setting a Foot of a New People, Prison Intellectuals, New African Communism, and the Making of Meditations on Frantz Fanon's Wretched the Earth, which kind of talks about some of the history that we have of what Yaki was doing in prisons in Illinois, some of the movements that he was a part of during the 60s, 70s, and the 80s, his role in
the New African Independence Movement, some of his connection with Sonika Shakur, but really the way in which he took up the writing of meditations as a way to, you know, provide a tool of for study, for reflection, for you know, prisoners who were trying to do that work of individual transformation in terms of, you know, transforming a criminal mentality into a revolutionary mentality, and really kind of educating and developing themselves as New Africans. And that was part of a broader project that was put together, released last year to mark the 60th anniversary of Frantz Fanon's Wretch of the Earth. And then the piece that I'm working on right now, hopefully it's going to be out by the end of this year, is called War for the City, Black Liberation and the Consolidation of the Carceral State. And again, could probably folks who have read Yaki's meditations, part of it is kind of drawing on or speaking to some of that influence in terms of looking at specifically the development of movements behind bars and on the streets of Chicago, behind bars in Illinois and on the streets of Chicago from like the 1950s to the early 1980s. So starting with Converts to the Nation of Islam in Stateville Prison, some of their organizing and prisoner litigation, the way that some of what the Nation was doing influenced those around in and around the Revolutionary Action Movement of the 1960s, and particularly its focus on organizing and politicizing street gang members, those involved in street organizations, and really how that particular history or how that particular kind of politic and strategy was carried out in Chicago in terms of efforts to engage with brothers involved in the Vice Lords, involved in the Black Peacestone, what became the Black Peacestone Nation, and other street formations, and really how they continued and informed not only organizing on the street through the 1960s, but then later behind bars during the 70s and 80s. Part of what I try to do is follow that all the way up to, you know, the time, by the time you get to the Arukans in the 1980s and 1990s in Chicago. So kind of look at the development of that particular line of struggle, but really try to pay attention to the way in which the state responds to those efforts. So how you get at some point some reforms in terms of, you know, what the Nation of Islam is doing behind bars, some transformations in terms of opening up opportunities for prisoner litigation, opening up opportunities for the practice of religion behind bars, for Islam, whether it's Sunni Islam or the kind of the version of Islam or the Nation of Islam, you know, for those to become a feature of prison life, for Eighth Amendment cases to be, you know, a viable sort of kind of legal avenue to be pursued. But more tangibly, how the state responded to what the Revolutionary Action Movement and then, you know, the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, and other formations we're looking to do in terms of engaging with street formations, how that prompted the organizing of the nation's first, you know, this country's first gang intelligence unit in terms of trying to monitor and specifically surveil street organizations, how that prompted a war on gangs in 1969 in Chicago, and then real efforts to transform the way in which, you know, prisons in Illinois operated up until the point where you have Chicago being one of the places where RICO statutes are first put into place, are first implemented in response to what street formations are doing, as opposed to just kind of focusing solely on the mafia and what have you, and how those kind of changes in policing that kind of get, you know, federal agencies more involved in policing street activities alongside changes behind bars that in Illinois, you know, eliminate parole, that change different features of how prisons, state prisons are being managed, and that ultimately help fuel the growth of the prison system in Illinois such that by the time we get to, like, the early 1990s, Illinois has one of the fastest growing prison systems in the country. That kind of similar questions, similar to what I was talking about when I talked about the rethinking the American prison movement in terms of trying to appreciate not only this real rich history of struggle that is very much reflective of what you talked about earlier in terms of how dynamics on the street are reflecting conditions behind bars, and conditions behind bars are, you know, things are going vice versa, that the need to appreciate that real close connection between what's taking place behind bars and what's taking place on the street is an important part of those movements. But on the other side, to appreciate and try to make sense of the way in which, in an effort to undermine those movements that range from kind of, you know, early on some civil rights demands, that prison rights demands that become a key aspect of nationalist struggle, that become a key aspect of the Black Liberation Movement, and then later, you know, the New African Independence Movement, that the effort to kind of to constrain that, to defeat that, different aspects of that become an important part of the development, the building up of the prison industrial slave complex, mass incarceration, you know, are key aspects of what get us to where we are today.
True indeed. My next question I want to ask you, let me see how I want to put it. I understand that you organized Chicago, right? But what compelled you to do so? What compelled you to organize Chicago as basically get involved in community activism? What inspired you? What were the catalysts, you know, to make
I mean,
it in for you to do that?
I mean, Chicago is in part it was just being inspired by the not just like the rich history of organizing in Chicago, but to see the way in which, you know, the especially, I think I first got to Chicago in 2006, and to see, you know, that there was this kind of real vibrant fight back that folks were involved in, and that inspired me to see the way in which folks were trying to push back against things that I don't want to make it seem as if like people aren't fighting back and aren't struggling wherever you find them. But I was just really impressed at the level at which folks were struggling and the way in which people were trying to push the movement forward. And so it was really just wanting to be, you know, a part of that, and, you know, make a positive contribution to it that really kind of got me involved and really made me like proud to be in that place and at that time. I remember when I first got there, I was learning about, you know, some of the struggles that were happening around the John Birch torture scandal and the scores of brothers who were behind bars who had been, you know, forced to confess to crimes they hadn't committed and were on death row, and then, you know, different maximum security facilities, the ways people, you know, there was a struggle around trying to stop Walmart from coming into the city without paying people, you know, like a fair wage. There was efforts to fight back against gentrification. There was just a lot of, you know, it's a big city, so that's one thing, but there was a lot of activity that gave me the impression that people weren't just kind of asleep and not really, you know, trying to, you know, push back in one way or another. So that's really kind of what drew me into things. One of the things that I had in particular been fortunate enough to experience is that when my mom had moved to South Africa, I had gotten an opportunity to see the way in which the movement in South Africa, even after, you know, the first democratic elections in 1994 and the ANC coming to power, was like being revitalized in a particular way where folks were struggling over some of the ways in which the ANC had effectively kind of betrayed some of the promises of that movement. The national liberation struggle there, the mass democratic movement there. And the thing that really amazed me about Chicago is I was able to connect with some people who had some sense of what had been happening in South Africa, who had either heard about some of the movements that I saw there, or were aware, or open to making some connections between, you know, the way in which folks in South Africa were struggling around evictions and circumstances in public housing in terms of people's, you know, just general conditions, people getting their water cut off, their electricity disconnected because they didn't have enough money to pay for it. Like, folks were real open to kind of making a connection between what they saw happening or what they heard about happening there and what was happening in Chicago. And it was that kind of level of consciousness in terms of, even on just some level, wanting to be able to see those connections and make those connections that you can certainly find in a lot of different places. But the way that I, was able to kind of link up with people in Chicago who were thinking in that kind of way, just really impressed me, and just wanted me to make sure that I had my
you know, my feet on the ground, my boots on the ground, and that I could, you know, make some kind of positive contribution.
True indeed.
Can you tell a little bit about some of the organizations you've been involved with in Chicago, such as STOP, the anti-eviction campaign, and some of the things that you were doing while involved with the organization?
Sure. So STOP was stands for the South Side Together Organizing for Power, which is mostly based in the Woodlawn neighborhood of on the South Side of Chicago. And I first connected with them mostly because they had they were fighting against gentrification that was taking place in and around the University of Chicago. And that really, I thought that was really important, being a student at the University of Chicago and just understanding how universities contribute to, you know, pushing people out of the neighborhood. I grew up in West Philadelphia, which is, you know, right near University of Pennsylvania. I saw a lot of that gentrification when I was growing up, and to the point where the neighborhood that we lived in basically got renamed University City in the kind of the image of the University of Pennsylvania. You know, I wasn't able to make all the connections when I was growing up, but as I better understood the situation, really wanted to, you know, connect with STOP and see what STOP was doing around that question of gentrification and displacement. And then the thing that really drew me into their work was they had a youth organization called Fearless Leading by the Youth, which was fighting, when I got involved with them, against the conditions in the juvenile detention center in Chicago. The name people usually goes by when people talk about it is called the Audi Home. And back in, I think, 2007, right after like a Kwanzaa celebration or a holiday celebration, there had been a protest by the youth who were being held there, and in response, they shut the facility down. And this is a facility that had like a whole history of, you know, inhumane conditions that children weren't supposed to be held in. On top of that being a norm, they locked down the facility. And this youth organization had taken it upon itself not just to protest the county commissioners who were responsible for the oversight of the facility, but they effectively said, like, look, if you're not going to be responsible in terms of making sure that, you know, the kids who are being held in these cages have proper, you know, like the basic necessities in terms of clean clothes, underwear. There were complaints about the young girls who were being held in the facilities having to, you know, wash out their sanitary materials in their own sinks and what have you, because they weren't being given new ones. That they were basically saying if the people who are getting paid to make sure that this facility is run at a certain standard can't provide those things, we're going to provide them for, you know, we'll provide it for you. So they, you know, they took boxes of clean underwear and sanitary napkins, you know, to the county building. They had a rap song, they had a hip hop song about the Cook County Board president, who at that time was one of the most powerful black elected officials in the city. So I was trying to, you know, work with them, was supporting their work. And then
a couple years later, one of the lead organizers of Fly, Fearless Leading by the Youth, was shot and killed a couple blocks away from the University of Chicago. And it was, like, that was tragic, not just because this was a, you know, this was a young brother who was organizing in his community and trying to figure out ways to, you know, to improve the circumstances there, but also he had lost some of his friends in and around the same neighborhood, and for years he and his friends had asked, you know, why is there no trauma center at the University of Chicago, and why is it that if somebody is shot, you know, minutes away from the hospital there, that they have to be taken 30, 45, maybe even upwards of an hour to a hospital on the other side of the city. So they started to raise those questions. And, you know, in the aftermath of this young brother, Damian Turner, being killed, you know, we, together with some of his friends, some of the organizers from STOP, some of his family members, not just to try to say this is an issue that he was focused on that needs to get addressed, but also in a way to say, you know, rather than, because it had been one of those kind of like random kind of drive-by shootings that it wasn't completely clear who was responsible for it, but rather than, you know, getting into a question of, you know, who was responsible, that we needed to be able to focus the attention, the anger, the grief that people were feeling on the larger institutional forces that were responsible for him losing his life in the first place. So just a couple weeks after his death, you know, we did a protest on the University of Chicago Hospital, and that was the start of what became like a multi-year campaign following his following Damian Turner's killing in August of 2010, a multi-year campaign to force the University of Chicago to, you know, to open up an adult trauma care center, a trauma center. And I was a student at the university at the time, so I was trying to figure out how I could leverage some of my, you know, my access at the university, some of the ways in which it was easy for the university to kind of dismiss, kids from the neighborhood, young brothers and sisters from the neighborhood. It was a little harder for them to do that when it came to some of their own students. It was still possible, but it was a little bit harder for them to do this. So to try to leverage some of that access was key. It was very easy for them to threaten to arrest, you know, the kids who came on campus and say, you know, if you don't get out of here, you're gonna end up locked up. It was a little bit harder for them to do that with their own students. So, you know, we tried to take advantage of those kind of differences to some degree and use that as a way to kind of help push that struggle forward. We were ultimately successful in that. And then, you know, the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign came out of this opportunity that emerged to bring one of the lead organizers of the Western Cape Anti-Eviction Campaign in South Africa, this organization that had been for a number of years fighting back against evictions from public housing, evictions from, from foreclosure and from houses that were being repossessed by the bank.
the banks there, and to bring the lead organizer Ashraf Tassin to Chicago. And we actually brought him around the country. We brought him to the Bay Area. We brought him to the Bay Area, Miami, D.C., New York City, Boston, Chicago, kind of East Coast, West Coast, and a little bit Midwest. So a little bit limited, but we tried to bring him to and connect him to a bunch of different folks who were involved with the foreclosure crisis that was taking place at the time in 2009. And, of all the groups that, all the community organizations and campaigns that folks were doing at that time, the folks who were, there were groups in Miami, like Take Back the Land, that were kind of had already heard about movements in South Africa and were trying to, like, build on some of those examples. But the one place that was most interested in terms of trying to kick things off in a way that kind of built off of those lessons of what was happening in South Africa was folks in Chicago, out of Cabrini Green, who had decades of struggle against displacement, ethnic cleansing, essentially, of the Cabrini Green complex there, who were most interested in trying to use some of the example and inspiration of the anti-eviction campaign. So they took it up and launched their own Chicago anti-eviction campaign as a way to fight back against the way in which different developers were trying to use all sorts of loopholes and misinterpretations of the law to try to empty out Cabrini of, like, the last few families that were still in some of the high rises there, taking people who had not lived in the unit, but maybe had, knew somebody or happened to be have their address at a particular place, and that person's arrest would be then the pretext to use the kind of one-strike rule to get somebody evicted. All that we were trying to fight back against. And then, from Cabrini, we're organizing mostly on the south side, trying to fight back against folks losing their homes. And really, in a way, had an opportunity to kind of, like, learn from the advances and the ways in which folks in South Africa had been doing this for a number of years, and doing it not just in a way where they would, ask nicely for somebody to stay in their home, but did mass militant protests against evictions and foreclosure in a way that weren't just about saying this is one particular family, but really understood that the kind of the ways in which an individual family might be losing their home was part of a broader attack on a community, and were involved in not just putting people back into their homes once they got evicted, but also taking homes that had been left empty and putting families that were homeless into those homes. And that's something that we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to do, in terms of trying to say there's, hundreds of homes, thousands of homes that are, as the foreclosure crisis was going, that were being left empty. And there were, thousands of homeless families. And how can we work with people in the community to actually make sure that
those families had a home and, you know, do what needed to be done in terms of fixing up that home, but make it livable for those families. And the powerful things for me in terms of being able to in terms of somebody who was fortunate enough to be a part of that was, one, how, you know, you go to people in the community and in a very common sense way, they were much more willing to have a homeless family have a place to stay and know and have some security that the home next to them wasn't being broken into, that the pipes weren't being taken out, that it wasn't going to turn into some kind of like, you know, it wasn't going to be used for some nefarious, a kind of antisocial reason. But actually that there was a benefit to having a family in the house, such that when the police would come, those neighbors were willing to stand up and support the effort as opposed to call the police to have people removed. But it took organizing and outreach and conversations with those neighbors to make sure that they were comfortable and supportive of the effort in the first place. And then, you know, that there was a real rich history that folks from Cabrini Green and other public housing developments had around doing that work already in the developments that they were coming from, in terms of not just moving folks into vacant units, but being in a position to say, we already have the skills in terms of fixing the plumbing or fixing the heating or whatever might need to be done, because in a place like Cabrini, you might put a complaint in because the water, you know, the heating is broken or the pipes are busted. You're going to be waiting a long time if you just wait for management to come fix it. And, you know, rather than waiting all that time, folks really gain the skills in terms of how to do that themselves. So there was a lot of skills. There was a lot of expertise that the people already had to be able to do that kind of work. And if we organized ourselves and really worked at organizing our communities, you know, we could deal with that situation when it doesn't really make sense on some level to have all these empty homes, all these vacant homes, and all these homeless families. The one other piece that I would mention that was a real, you know, that I really learned a lot from in terms of that time in Chicago was there was a group called Rising in Solidarity with IET, which was just a small crew of us who were doing some support for Haitian grassroots movements after the 2010 earthquake. And a lot of that was really trying to make the connections between the impact of U.S. imperialism on Haiti beyond just the devastation of the earthquake and the ways in which those same forces have impacted our communities, and really just trying to, you know, make a clear a clear connection between, you know, what happens to our people in different countries around the world, whether that's the Caribbean or whether that's Central America, South America, on the African continent, and some of the problems that we face here, that was that kind of internationalist perspective was just an essential part of trying to understand the way in which the world works, and that part of what we were doing was really trying to have, we had like a multi-generational crew of folks who were part of that work. And I think one of our biggest projects was trying to deal with the American Red Cross and the role that they had played in terms of as a so-called charitable institution, one that was sort of accepting all these donations, that folks have put forward after the earthquake in 2010, and then the kind of complete lack of like positive contribution on the ground in terms of what they were putting those donations towards. And instead of, you know, helping people to build homes or, you know, providing food with the millions of dollars that they received, how much of that they just kind of put into their own pocket in terms of, you know, official salaries and things of that nature. And so we were part of groups relatively early on that were trying to kind of raise attention to that, those kind of practices. But yeah, man, I really felt blessed to be a part of the work that folks were doing there, because there were a lot of ways in which I got to, you know, even though I wasn't from Chicago, I was from out of town, there was a lot of ways in which the struggles that people were carrying forward were, you know, real opportunities for me to learn from and to improve my own practice, my own skills as an organizer, but then also kind of, you know, learn from people who had been putting in work for decades and try to put into practice some of the lessons that they had learned in today's day and time.
Okay. I have like one more question, and you probably gonna wrap it up.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about BAP and what is BAP do?
Sure. So BAP stands for Black Alliance for Peace, and it's a international human rights anti-war organization that is organizing in the amongst New Africans in the Black community, basically trying to, I think first and foremost, trying to build a lot more that internationalist consciousness that I kind of spoke to earlier in terms of making connections between what happens to people of African descent abroad and what happens to us here. An easy way to kind of think about that is like the ways in which the use of military equipment might have been in service for a number of years is sold to police here in the United States, or really given to police here in the United States through a program that was really developed during the Clinton administration and has, you know, was kind of escalated during the Obama years, that is kind of like one example of the connections between U.S. imperialism and the imperialism that takes place at home, but really focused on trying to confront U.S. militarism in places like Africa, particularly with the establishment and the development of AFRICOM, which is the U.S. Africa Command, which was first proposed during the Bush administration and really launched in during the Obama years as a kind of function of the U.S. military command that was specifically tasked with overseeing U.S. operations on the African continent and has, for a number of years, African countries were resistant, were unwilling to kind of participate in what AFRICOM was looking to do, but it was under kind of the, you know, the amidst the kind of mystique of what Obama seemed to promise, that there was first some acceptance of it, that U.S. Africa Command, whether it's been involved in training soldiers from different African countries, whether it's been involved in coordinating, kind of most infamously, the airstrikes that would serve as the kind of first wave of the attacks on the Libyan government under Muammar Gaddafi, whether it was kind of the more direct kind of interventions like what we saw with Gaddafi, or the more kind of less obvious, more in the background, examples of operations that have kind of taken place in terms of the training of different military officers in different parts of the African continent, some who have more recently been involved in coups in different parts of the continent, is a question of U.S. militarism that we need to be involved in challenging and need to be aware of, not just calling attention to and challenging, but also in the position to make connections with movements in Africa that are challenging what AFRICOM is doing, a lot of grassroots struggles that are trying to fight back against U.S. military presence and really the emphasis on militarism that the U.S. has been pushing, but also very much in the position to kind of make connections between the ways in which the use of particular forms of military activity that are taking place abroad. And more recently, we've also kind of raised attention to some of what's been taking place in the Southern Hemisphere, whether it's U.S. military activity in different parts of Central America, places like Colombia, parts of the Caribbean, that those kind of activities that have a direct impact on people of African descent, African people in those countries, ultimately comes home. And, you know, we saw that most recently, not quite coming home, but kind of some of those connections playing out when it came to the assassination of the President Moise in Haiti last year, when you had U.S.-trained Colombian mercenaries involved in carrying out that assassination, and the ways in which the kind of extensions of what different forces of U.S. imperialism are involved in doing reverberate in ways that, at least in the case of Haiti, even though the various different aspects of what Moise was involved in that were anti-democratic and were really deeply corrupt and were also against
Points up, brother. We got like 5 minutes left, man. Can you give your final thoughts?
Yeah, sure. My bad. I just again appreciate the opportunity. Come on the platform and just want to say I very much appreciate the work that George Jackson University has been involved in doing in terms of its specific mission, and just more broadly the contribution that it's making, and that part of what I'm trying to do with the scholarship is try to kind of, as we talked about a little earlier, trying to build on and try to, see what we can learn from some of the examples of what the foundations that's already been laid in terms of how we might best understand the role and the work of the prison industrial slave complex, but also how the struggles that have taken place behind bars impact the way in which the system itself has developed, and then also the kind of connections between the need to appreciate the connections between what happens in prisons and what happens in our community, and that those aren't, separate, but those are deeply intertwined. And that's something that's informed my own work as a scholar and as a organizer. And then that, something that I'm looking forward to being more in conversation with folks who listen to this program about, in terms of how we can not just better appreciate those connections, but how we can use those as opportunities to push the struggle forward.
Okay. I appreciate that. Again, I appreciate you coming to our platform, sharing all your understanding. Thank you for working on in the past, the present, and the future. I wish you success upon all your work. And if anyone had any comrade, little one, associates behind enemy line, please link it to our website, which is www.georgejackuniversity.com. Again, it's www.georgejackuniversity.com. Long live the resistance, law, learn the African movement, and the struggle of land independence.